This is an ad by Regain Couples Therapy and features real testimonials.
This was our first time trying therapy, and honestly, it was long overdue. Looking back, we just wish we had started sooner.
Regain's qualified therapists help couples when they can't get there on their own.
We thought it was intimacy issues, but Andrea helped us uncover a deeper root cause we hadn't even realized was there.
Visit regain.com/couplespod to get 10% off your first month. Regain, powered by BetterHelp.
Finding great candidates to hire can be like, well, trying to find a needle in a haystack. Sure, you can post your job to some job board, but then all you can do is hope the right person comes along. Which is why you should try ZipRecruiter for free at ziprecruiter.com/zip. ZipRecruiter doesn't depend on candidates finding you. It finds them for you. Its powerful technology identifies people with the right experience and actively invites them to apply to your job. You get qualified candidates fast. So while other companies might deliver a lot of hay, ZipRecruiter finds you what you're looking for. The needle in the haystack.
See why 4 out of 5 employers who post a job on ZipRecruiter get a quality candidate within the first day. ZipRecruiter, the smartest way to hire. And right now, you can try ZipRecruiter for free. That's right, free. At ZipRecruiter.com/zip. That's ZipRecruiter.com/zip. ZipRecruiter.com/zip.
Welcome to the Gravity Podcast, where we host conversations on developing a Christian spirituality rooted in love that fosters resilient faith in everyday life. Well, 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 look what we have here. Christine.
I feel like we should start again and say, okay. Happy birthday, USA.
Happy birthday.
Well, we are a few days after America's birthday.
Yeah, this will come out four days after America's birthday.
Everybody's okay. Yeah,
they're still wearing the red, white, and blue. They're still remembering the fireworks.
Yeah, there's still the dirty margaritas and the igloo cooler and the smell of sulfur in the air.
Yep. Much to my dog's chagrin.
Eating leftover hot dogs from the cookout for breakfast.
Gross.
You know, Ben likes hot dog bowls.
Oh my gosh, please don't do that. That would make a really good youth group game, though. Just blend up those hot dogs.
Ooh,
make them into a shake and see if a kid would eat it. Mm. Would you drink a blended hot dog shake, Ben?
I would never.
Matt, would you drink a blended hot dog milkshake?
It depends. It depends on who's watching.
Right. Who am I trying to impress?
If I pulled you up on stage at youth group, you would totally drink it.
The calculus for me is all context dependent. Like, I'm not even, you know, if you gave me 10 grand, I'd drink anything. But it's context dependent on what would the impact be of the people in the room, and would I appreciate that more than I would hate drinking the hot dog smoothie? And that's usually the calculus I can figure out pretty quick.
Yeah.
Interesting.
Okay, well, you know? That is one. I do not like drinking gross things.
No.
Oh.
No. Remember Fear Factor?
Oh, yeah.
And Fear Factor basically became, that's a show, Joe Rogan was the host, and it became two things. One, like people enduring the fear of heights.
Yep.
And people putting really disgusting things in their mouth.
Yeah.
Like that basically were the two categories. And those are the two things that I actually cannot do. Like heights. If I see like a parkour person like jumping off a roof to another roof on like my Instagram reels, I am swiping that as fast as I can.
Get that out of my sight.
And then there's people that are like, you know, just eat things that we don't typically eat, like bugs or
I've eaten a grasshopper.
Oh. Yeah. How was it?
Roasted?
It was just dry and crunchy. It was fine.
It's all about the seasoning for grasshoppers, you know?
Yeah, if you put chocolate on it, I bet it'd be great.
As far as we know.
Yeah. Well, I don't know. I don't know if I would eat a hot dog smoothie. I am hungry right now, though. And it doesn't sound as bad to me as I wish it did.
You might go find those hot dogs, blend them up, and try it.
Yeah. All right. Are you guys ready for another Gen Alpha slang?
Oh my gosh! Quiz.
We're gonna
again?
Just do one. We're gonna do one word today. Just one
just
word.
One word. Okay. Okay.
All right. Short one.
All right. So the phrase. Remember, just say your name.
Yep. Okay. To buzz in.
To buzz in.
Yeah.
The phrase is phantom tax.
Phantom?
Nope.
You say phantom?
Phantom.
Phantom tax.
Phantom tax.
It's, Christy, it's yes. taking, it's taking something, like taxing is taking something from somebody. And I don't know, because like I heard a kid say you taxed something about you tax my tags, and tags were like those little tiny things like on your zippers, like of like backpacks or sweatshirts or whatever. And they were taking those little cords. So they were, so I'm guessing that phantom tax is like secretly taking something from somebody.
Yes. Mm. This is good. Okay. So okay. Christy, I'm going to give you the points here. This is good
wait.
Because
Ben, do you get to guess? Does he get to guess?
Well,
I think I already know that. I mean, I really had no clue about that.
I could tell by Ben's affect and face that he had no clue what that was. Yeah.
I was like, I'm not even going to try to make up a funny version of this. I can't even get there.
So phantom tax started as a phrase to describe a friend playfully or jokingly taking food from another friend. Okay. So you hit them with the phantom tax. You like take one of their fries.
I gotcha.
Or take one of their dino nuggets, you know?
Yep.
Or, you know, you swipe their hot dog smoothie. But now, nice. Now that a tax is use has expanded to do what the work that you're talking about, Christy. Hmm. So like it's playfully or jokingly swiping anything from a friend.
Right. Right.
Right. So phantom tax was about food. Now hit them with the tax or tax them. Is swiping anything from a friend.
Okay.
But I think it has to be done playfully because it's not a euphemism for stealing. It's right. gotta be something that is not socially egregious.
But is it like obvious? Do they know you're doing it? Or is it kind of secretive?
Well, now we're getting a little farther into this than I'm prepared to talk.
Okay.
I do think
he didn't study this much.
I do think that it's got to be playful. So like for instance, if you swipe it and somebody comes back and thinks somebody stole something, you don't tell them. That's not
right.
That sort of violates the phantom tax.
Right. That's not cool. Okay.
That's not cool. Not cool. You know who is cool? Shannon Kearns.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Hey there.
Shannon Kearns is a transgender man who believes in the transformative power of story. He's an ordained priest, writer, and theologian whose work revolves around making meaning. He's also a sought-after speaker on transgender issues and religion, as well as a skilled workshop facilitator. Kearns's work with Brian G. Murphy at queertheology.com, which he co-founded, has reached more than a million people all over the world through videos, articles, and online courses. He joins us today to talk about his new book, No One Taught Me How to Be a Man, What a Trans Man's Experience Reveals About Masculinity. Excited to bring this to you, friends, today. Let's listen to Shannon. Shannon, welcome to the Gravity Commons podcast.
Thanks so much for having me. I'm really looking forward to this conversation.
Yeah, we are too. Hey, as we get into this conversation about your book, No One Taught Me How to Be a Man, I wonder if, by way of introduction, if you could give a bit of your story about being a Christian and being a trans man. Like, how did those identities emerge for you and how do they shape and form each other?
Yeah. Yeah. My Cliff Notes story is always that I grew up a fundamentalist evangelical who became the first openly transgender man ordained to the old Catholic priesthood. And that usually just engenders more more questions than answers. So I grew up in a rural community in Pennsylvania, and the church was pretty much my entire life. So really spent a lot of time in the church. At that time, I didn't really understand denomination. So I would have just said, you know, we were Christians. Looking back, it's clear that we were evangelical, more on the fundamentalist side of that, in a specific lineage. And I knew from a young age that I was different than other kids, but you know, I grew up in the 80s and 90s. So this is a time before we didn't have cable TV. I didn't have access to the internet. I was pretty sheltered. And so a lot of my understanding of myself was languageless. And I think that really shapes like how I grew up, right? It was this sense of disconnect, but no language around that, right? I didn't really even know gay people existed probably until I was in my late teens. And so I had no idea that there were transgender people, that was a thing, that was an option. And yet I also kind of knew in my very being that I was not like my peers, and that I was having a different experience of my body and of moving through the world in that body than other kids that I was growing up around. And so that left me with this real sense of, you know, I think something might be wrong with me. And that was not helped by the church that I grew up in, which, you know, their big thing was that something is wrong with everyone. And so, you know, it really this sense of like guilt and shame and that I was not measuring up was kind of heavy in my life. So then I did start to kind of come out at an evangelical Christian college as gay. And then it was another probably 5 or 7 years before I realized like, trans people exist and I think I'm one of them, and came out as trans while I was in seminary. And so my faith during that time was also kind of shifting and growing, not necessarily because of my sexuality or gender identity, but because I was having questions about the things that I had been taught growing up. And I didn't really ever leave the church. I think I'm someone who has really always felt that Christianity was the guiding principle that shaped my life. And you know, now I would say that, you know, I've been so steeped in Christianity that I don't think I can leave it, right? It's the language that I come from. It is a story that gives me so much meaning and that really guides how I show up in the world. But the Christianity that I subscribe to now is obviously very different than the Christianity that I grew up with. And that's been a long journey. So that's kind of a snapshot of my story.
Yeah. You mentioned being an old Catholic priest.
Yes.
And you're not describing middle age there.
Correct.
Right. Could you help us understand what is old Catholic and how that's separate from maybe Roman Catholic or other Catholic?
Sure. Yeah. So the Old Catholic Church is an independent, progressive Catholic group that is not in communion with Rome. Many independent or old Catholics ordain women, LGBTQ folks, people who are married, partnered, and divorced. It started in the 1700s, I believe, in the Netherlands. The Wikipedia article on the Old Catholic Church is actually pretty good if you want to do a deep, deep nerdy dive. You know, started over political things and then has shifted. Came to the U.S. about 250 years ago. Some rogue bishops came over here and started ordaining people, which I find kind of delightful. And so there is this kind of movement in the U.S. of independent Catholics. They fall under a lot of different names and ways of organizing themselves, but usually a bishop and priests, small congregations, a lot focused on social justice and on, I think the like combination of liturgy, contemplation, and action, which is what drew me to the old Catholics.
Yeah. Yeah, Ben, had were you familiar with the Old Catholics?
I'd heard people talk about Old Catholic, you know, as a movement, as a group, but I had never known much about it. I'm actually looking at the Wikipedia page. I got curious as you were talking about it. And it looks like there's two groups, the Union of Utrecht and the Union of Scranton. Is that right? I'm getting into the
weeds. Yeah, and then there's even more. Okay. You know, they're anyway, like all deal. Good folks, yep. Schisms and fractures mm-hmm. and disagreements over politics organization, yeah. But, you know.
Yeah. Anyway, I was just noticing one of them was in communion with the Anglican Communion, which the Episcopal Church that Matt and I are part of is part of that. So,
yep.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, let's talk about a little bit about like the topic of your book, Shannon, you know, is manhood and masculinity. This has become quite a contested battleground for us these days. And I wonder if you have any insight about why that is. Like, why has that become such a big deal, such a contested subject? What do you think is at stake in that conversation?
Oh, that's a huge question. You know, I think one of the things that, one of the reasons that this has become such a big topic is because, we haven't talked about masculinity well, for such a long time. And so I think that we've seen all of these, you know, other groups and movements who have really wrestled with culture and have wrestled with the status quo and have wrestled with power and privilege and how they fit and interact and navigate with those things. And men just like didn't engage in those conversations. Obviously I'm painting with a really wide brush, but I think like overall men didn't engage with those conversations. And so the world moved and changed very rapidly. And I think men now are finally realizing like, oh, the world has changed and we haven't. And now there's this disconnect of like, where do we fit in this new space? How do we show up? Like, can we show up? And I think in the midst of that, there is this sense for some men, I think especially white cis men, that, you know, this sense of like losing power and privilege that has now caused a digging in of the heels, a desire to like return to the quote unquote good old days. I think that we're seeing that kind of fracturing happening. But then I think that there are a lot of men who are not wanting that, but are also realizing like, we don't know how to have these conversations, but like clearly something isn't working. Like we're not feeling right in ourselves. We're not feeling right in our relationships, but like, what does that look like? And I think that like, that is the moment that we're in. And it's a really beautiful moment if we take advantage of it. And it could lead to some really wonderful and lovely things. But I think we are also seeing, you know, the kind of negative side of that, of folks who are wanting to really push any progress of other groups down, because there's this feeling of competition.
Yeah. It's almost like we took it for granted, both maybe the good and the bad of what it means to be a man, like masculinity. We took it for granted for so long. And now a lot of the toxic elements of that are being brought into the light. And there's this simultaneous, like you said, there's a doubling down on some people about like, now let's just get back to all this stuff is fine. It's all fine. And actually more of it, please. But then for those of us who don't want to do that, there is this sort of like scary open space of like, well, what does it actually mean then?
Yeah. You
know? Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah. And in many ways, your book is a wrestling with this, Shannon, that I think is so helpful, was so helpful for me. And so I wonder if you could explore a bit. This is sort of a macro or meta question about like the wrestling between like your experience of feeling like a man. Yeah. So deciding to become, to transition, but also not really knowing what it meant to be a man, and also feeling like the dominant or preeminent image of manhood didn't fit you. And so then, I don't know if this is, tell me if this is a fair question. Like, how do you know that being a man fits if most of the models on offer aren't quite right?
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, I think that this is the question. And my answer is going to be unsatisfying, I think. and because it was also, right, it was the big thing that I wrestled with even in the book of like, I don't want to define what a man is because I don't think that that's helpful. And I think that that is often where we trip into terrible conversations about masculinity. So like for myself, the best I can say is like, it is this gut knowing, right? It is this knowing, that this fits. And I will say for me, it was like the moment, maybe not the moment, but you know, as I started trying on the language of masculinity, it was this sense of like, oh, this is what's been wrong my whole life. Like this is the naming of the silence that I have dealt with since I hit puberty. And there is just this sense now of like, as I move through the world and am seen by people, that they are seeing me correctly. Mm-hmm. And so I think then, you know, to broaden that out, for me, then what becomes important is that I think that there are always going to be people for whom man or male or masculinity feels right, that it feels like home for them, even if they can't even define what that is, right? Mm-hmm. There's this sense of like, yes, this is my identity. And so if that's the case, then how do we support people in broadening their view of what that could mean and living into that and embodying that in ways that feel healthy and right and good for both them and for the people that they're in relationships with? And that to me feels like a more interesting question than like, how do we define what being a man is or who gets to call themselves that? And I think also takes us out of this space of for folks who say, well, like we should just get rid of gender entirely. And I don't necessarily even disagree with that. I just think that there are going to be people for whom some place on the binary spectrum is going to feel comfortable for them. Yeah. And I know that that's for me, like, I feel like I've fought really hard to claim my masculinity and my space as a man. And that feels right to me. And moving into a genderless space doesn't feel right for me. And so like, how do I then support people who, for whom that does feel right, while also holding to what feels right in my own body?
Yeah.
We'll be right back.
The Gravity Podcast is sponsored by the Gravity Formation Course, a 12-month cohort-based training in practical spiritual formation, where you'll learn to notice how God is already at work in your life so you can participate more fully in the life God shares with us. It's a discipleship process that goes beyond just gaining more knowledge and trying some new practices. In the Gravity Formation Course, we go below the surface of our lives so we can notice and name our deepest desires in God's presence and discern how God is at work in those desires to lead us toward holistic flourishing, more transformation, more life, more joy, more love. We've trained hundreds of people from all over the world in this formation framework, and it has helped many to have a sense of God at work in their lives and learn to be more at home in God's love. If you'd like to learn more, go to gravitycommons.com/formation. Let's get back to the show.
Yeah, there's a sense in which one of my reflections about what you said is like, you know, I'm a cis man. And I, like, if I was asked the same question, like, what does it mean for you to be a man? I probably have a very similar answer. You know, it's like, well, I don't know. Like, but I have always just felt comfortable, like in my body. I've felt comfortable with, you know, the gender that I just assumed for my whole life. But there is an intuitive knowing of it that I just haven't had to asks the same questions, right? That you have or trans people have. And so that's an interesting answer. Maybe related to, you know, what you just shared, you know, in the book, you talk about the diversity of conversations and opinions in the trans community among trans people about what it means to be trans. You bring up the acronym TERF, which, if you don't know what that stands for, Trans Exclusionary Radical Feminists, listener. Just as one example of that kind of diversity. And I wonder if you can share briefly sort of the landscape of this diversity and why it's important for your project.
Yeah, I think that, you know, bringing up TERFs and where we are currently in this political moment, not just in the United States, but really all over the world, with this a real backlash against trans people in particular, anyone who kind of doesn't conform to the gender binary, we are in a really scary moment for trans folks. And I think that part of what feels super concerning to me is that there are even folks within the larger LGBTQ community, right, who are not supportive of trans folks, like folks who identify as TERFs and in that space. And so I think that, like, this is a moment to really be cognizant of the attacks that are happening for trans folks, and to realize that, like, it's really, really important, if you are someone who does support trans folks, that you be really active and vocal in that support, and that you're actually, like, doing things to support trans folks. Because there are even people within the larger queer community who are not. And I think that that is so scary. But I think that, you know, the larger issue is that, well, A, trans folks become in many ways a canary in a coal mine. When we're looking at larger movements that have fascist leanings, right? That trans folks are easy to attack, and it's easy to see how far and how much support they will or they won't have. And if they can do it to trans folks, then they can do it to other folks. So I think we're seeing some of that. But I think the larger picture is that gender nonconforming folks in many cultures have always been threatening. We threaten status quo. We threaten stability. But the beauty of it is that part of that threat is to say, is to offer the question of, like, you get to choose how you inhabit and embody your life and your identity. And I think that that's what's so beautiful about trans identity is that intentionality. And especially since so many of us transitioned at great cost to ourselves, and without people wanting us to, and have done it anyway, in a pursuit of wholeness and health, that it becomes this really beautiful model to say, like, you can choose to be intentional about how you show up in the world, even when people disagree with that. So I'm not sure that answered your question, but I think that, like, as I'm thinking about the landscape of where we are right now, those are the things that feel important to me to kind of pull out, and there are more threads that I'm sure we can unravel there. But
yeah. One of the things you talk about in your book, Shannon, that I resonated with is the necessity of community or people to journey with as you're working out what does it mean to be a man. How does masculine make sense for you? And sprinkled throughout, you talk about that you were partnered when you decided to transition. And I'm wondering, what was that conversation like? And how did your partner accompany you in ways that were helpful in this as you transitioned?
Yeah, you know, it was an interesting time. I will say that. You know, I transitioned in 2008. And so trans folks were just starting to kind of hit the zeitgeist, if you will. You know, we still didn't have very many representations of trans folks on television, especially not trans masculine folks. But I transitioned, I was in seminary in New York. And so I felt really lucky to be in a city at that particular time. And there was a group of guys that came together, and they they formed the Transmasculine Community Network, which was just this social group to have conversations and connections with one another outside of medical situations, right? Because so many folks were going to support groups or they were meeting in doctor's rooms. And so this became a place to like have a barbecue or go out to dinner. And there were partners that were in the midst of that. And so as I started my transition, I was partnered at the time to a cis woman whose identity as a lesbian was really, really important to her. And I think that she tried very hard to be supportive in the beginning of my transition. But I think that as soon as I started to be recognized more as myself, it rendered her invisible in ways that I didn't really understand at the time, because I was in my own head in ways that were not helpful to either of us. And I think that really caused friction between us. Like my becoming visible made her invisible. And that became the thing that eventually we split over. But I also think that something else that was interesting at that time was that the narratives around dating a trans person, like if you Googled in 2008, like my partner came out as trans, it was just horror story after horror story, right? There wasn't at that time any real narrative of my partner came out as trans and we like figured out a way to make it work. It was almost all like all of the online community boards were you're going to have to break up or like this isn't going to work. And so I think that also was just in the air. And so it was really hard to find examples of support, to see other people who had gone through the same thing. I think had I been going through the same thing in now, it would be a much different conversation. But back then, that was just like not how the world was working. There weren't a lot of examples of that. And there weren't a lot of spaces, I think, even in the queer community, of people navigating shifting identities or figuring out what it looked like to embrace maybe a queer identity that was more encompassing of different genders. And so I think that all of that was just a really hard thing. And I'm grateful that it seems that the conversation has moved in some ways and made more space for people to find wholeness and to figure out how to navigate and support and love one another, even in the midst of that. And I will say that, you know, I don't always think that breaking up is a bad thing, right? that relationship ended badly. And also I'm really grateful for the ways in which I was shaped in that relationship, but also for the ways in which the ending of that freed me, to be in healthier spaces for myself.
Yeah.
I'd love to focus a little bit on sort of the intersection of faith and the scriptures with some of what we've been talking about here. You know, the phrases biblical manhood, biblical womanhood, they get thrown around a lot in Christian spaces. And, you know, any listener to our podcast regularly will know that we don't endorse any of that stuff, because we think they, you know, that reinforces hierarchies that do some harm and supremacy frameworks, all that kind of thing. But you do have some helpful comments in your chapter on God-ordained masculinity that seem to maybe reclaim how our Christian faith can inform our embodiment of gender. I wonder if you'd share some thoughts about that.
Yeah. I first want to say that, you know, I think some folks were surprised that I talked about religion in this book, and it felt to me that it was impossible to talk about masculinity and not to talk about religion, both because like my own experience of my life was shaped by growing up in evangelical spaces. But I think that whether you like it or not, evangelical conceptions of gender are like in the air and in the water and in everything that we do, especially in the United States, whether it's named that way or not. But right, like even the ideas of like what it is to be a good American is framed in this, you're patriotic, you're married to someone of the opposite sex, you have a lot of kids, you like live in the suburbs, right? Like that even idea of the 50s notion of whatever it is to be a good American is like straight out of the evangelical playbook. So like we have to understand where that comes from. And I think that like grappling with that is really important. I think for me, one of the things that as my faith has shifted, right, I see in scripture, in the Jesus story in particular, someone who did consistently break boundaries and binaries around gender, right? Like the way that Jesus lived out his masculinity was very different than his time, right? He was pushing back against so many of the barriers of his own time and place. And that so much of what even the early church was doing was also breaking those boundaries and was looking at like, what does it mean to be a citizen of heaven and not a citizen of Rome? And I think that now, as we look at what does it mean to be a citizen of heaven and not a citizen of the United States, right? Like we're seeing that same, there's still such richness for conversation of like, what does it look like to show up in solidarity with the most marginalized, with the most oppressed? What does it look like to center poor people in our movements? What does it look like to hear the voices of people who are incarcerated? What does it look like to be in solidarity with them? I think that all of these things push back against this notion of what it means to be a good man, a good American. And like my faith so influences how I look at the world. And by that also then influences how I show up and embody my gender. I don't know if that entirely answers your question, but those are some ways that my brain goes when you ask it that way.
Yes, for sure. Super helpful.
Yeah. And I think that's related to the conversation of how does gender come to be? So, you know, you have gender essentialists who are, you know, gender is sort of this trans cultural universal norm. And then you have, you know, this idea that gender is socially constructed. How do you move from like the particularities of Jesus, for instance, queering sort of some gender ideas in his day to claiming today, like this is a faithful expression of masculinity? I'm hoping that question isn't too abstract. Because I do think we get stuck between gender means nothing, or it's completely culturally constructed, or gender means only this thing, and you have to comport to this ideal. And I wonder how you navigate that, Shannon, as you embody being a man in the world.
Yeah. I mean, I think it's a couple of things. Right. Part of it goes back to that deep intuitive knowing and to paying attention and being intentional as to what feels good in my body and what feels good when I'm showing up in places. And I say it like that because I think that part of that is pushing back against whatever is constructed, right? Because sometimes we show up in ways that don't feel good in our bodies because it feels like we're expected to show up in those ways. And so I think for me, part of the work of figuring out my own masculinity and hopefully showing up well in the world is to really pay attention to how I'm showing up by my body and what feels natural and good. But then the next piece of that is also making sure that as I'm doing that, I'm not doing any harm to the people around me and to the people I'm wanting to be in solidarity with. And so that does look like paying attention for me about the fact that I'm a white man. And so how does my privilege play into things? Even if I don't always feel that I have that privilege, people are assuming that I do, or they're affording different things to me because of the assumptions that they're making about who I am and how I was born. And so that gets really complicated and murky. And also, I think that that's important, right? Like, I have to figure out how to do that work and how to show up well. And so that's a piece of it too, of like, it doesn't matter if me feeling good in my body or showing up in a certain way feels right, if that is also doing harm to people around me. So then I have to like figure out the balance and the nuance in the midst of that. And I think that that is really important work. And then I think too, it's also about, you know, being in conversation with people who don't share the same experiences I do, and figuring out how we can show up for one another and how we can be in community together. And that feels like an important piece of the conversation too. And so I think that some of this is abstract, but for me, it all comes back to being anchored in like embodiment and in community. And how do we do that work together well?
Yeah. Yeah. Maybe as a example of this, one of your chapters is about finding safety in your body. And it struck me as significant because I think that many of us never have to feel unsafe in our bodies. Mm. And then many of us have to work really hard to find a modicum of safety. And you share some experiences about how you learned to navigate space differently as a man versus how you navigated space as a woman. And I wonder if you could share a few of those so we can get a flavor of like what kind of work that was for you.
Yeah. Yeah, I think especially in my early transition when I knew who I was, but I wasn't always seen as who I was in public. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. You know, it was trying to figure out how do I navigate these spaces in a way that makes me legible to other people, but also keeps me safe. And so some of that was like around, you know, I realized that when I checked out at a bookstore, for instance, if I was really friendly to the person who was checking me out and I smiled a lot and I talked more, I would get misgendered. And so figuring out like, oh, but if I don't smile and I speak in a monotone and very short sentences, I get gendered properly. So then it became like, okay, well then I'm going to tamp down what is my natural response and what feels good so that I'm seen in this moment. And like, obviously, probably the cashier experience wasn't going to put me in danger, but a situation where I'm going into the restroom might. And so like learning, you know, you don't talk to people in the restrooms and you keep your eyes on the floor and you like you navigate that space differently. And so figuring out how to hold my body in certain situations, especially early in transition, meant often cutting off a fuller range of expression and emotion.
Yes, yes.
And then thankfully, like once the testosterone had started to do its job, I was able to bring back and re-enfold more ranges of expression and embodiment that I could and still be considered safe. And yet, even now, I'm very aware of the fact that if I get outed, whatever perceived safety I might have in a situation goes away, right? And so then that becomes this dance too. Like I remember I was with a friend at a baseball game and they like asked me a question about something trans related. And I just had this moment of panic of like, oh, if this outs me and someone is drunk behind me and they follow me to the bathroom, like suddenly what had felt like a safe space where I was being gendered correctly now becomes a potentially fraught space because if someone overheard that comment or conversation. And I think that we don't often talk about that. And that's something that I'm just aware of all the time in ways that I think that other people aren't.
Yeah.
And yet I also know from talking with cis men in my life that they too are often doing this calculation of, sure. Oh, did I gesture in a way that makes me look effeminate in this moment, in this bar, that's going to make someone say something to me? Or like, how do I show, my friend just said something really awful, or my coworker said something really awful. If I call them on it, is that going to cause them to like question my sexuality or gender, right? Like, I think that we're often doing this dance. And I think that that's why it's so important that we talk about this, because I think I have a unique perspective on it because of my experience, but I think it's just that I'm more aware of what lots of us are doing all the time and not naming and not talking about, which I think is why it's so important that we like listen to trans people when we talk about gender, because it's obviously we have a really unique perspective and experience. And also I think it opens up a window that is much broader than our own experience.
And now a word from a sponsor.
This is an ad by Regain Couples Therapy. Let's be honest. Loving your partner doesn't mean you always like them, and guess what? That's normal. Regain offers couples therapy that's flexible, affordable, and 100% online. Whether you're reconnecting or working through conflict, Regain is here to support you both. See why people wish they'd try couples therapy sooner. Visit regain.com/couplespod to get 10% off your first month. That's regain.com/couplespod.
Finding great candidates to hire can be like, well, trying to find a needle in a haystack. Sure, you can post your job to some job board, but then all you can do is hope the right person comes along. Which is why you should try ZipRecruiter for free at ZipRecruiter.com/zip. ZipRecruiter doesn't depend on candidates finding you. It finds them for you. Its powerful technology identifies people with the right experience and actively invites them to apply to your job. You get qualified candidates fast. So while other companies might deliver a lot of hay, ZipRecruiter finds you what you're looking for. The needle in the haystack.
See why 4 out of 5 employers who post a job on ZipRecruiter get a quality candidate within the first day. ZipRecruiter, the smartest way to hire. And right now, you can try ZipRecruiter for free. That's right, free. At ZipRecruiter.com/zip. That's ZipRecruiter.com/zip. ZipRecruiter.com/zip.
Your child deserves an education that sets them up for success. K-12 knows that learning isn't one size fits all and has options tailored to each child's needs, interests, and goals for the future. K-12 powered schools are tuition-free, accredited online public schools for students in kindergarten through 12th grade. Students learn at their speed, at home, from state-certified teachers specially trained to teach online. Join the more than 3 million families who've chosen K-12. Go to k12.com/podcast to enroll today.
All right, let's get back into our conversation.
Maybe as we come to a close here, Shannon, I wonder, like, where do we start? You know, if we're kind of listening to this interview, resonating with your story, you know, besides getting your book, obviously. But if we're resonating with the story, and we want to like maybe grow in our understanding. You know, we do have a lot of work to do there, especially in the church. You know, what steps can we take, or what things can we do toward that end?
I mean, the biggest thing I really want to encourage folks to do is to find one person to start that you can talk to even start to have these conversations, to wrestle with some of these questions, to admit the places that you feel unsure of, right? Or where you're trying to figure out a new way of being, or even just to, you know, open up a conversation about like, what does masculinity mean to you? So I think that work is really important. I also think on an individual level, right, starting to even ask the question, is there something about the way that I'm showing up in the world that like isn't working for me? Whether that is, I don't feel like I have enough close friends, or something in my relationship feels off, or I don't have the relationship with my kids that I want to have, and start to ask those questions of like, how might my conceptions or assumptions about gender be playing into that, be playing into how I'm showing up in my family, how I'm showing up in my friendships, how I'm showing up in my community or church. I think even just opening that door a little bit might feel really scary to some folks. And I think that there's some interesting things might come out if you even just start to ask that question. And that's why I also then think having someone to talk about it with is really important.
Yeah. That's one of the reasons, Shannon, why I was so excited to talk to you. Because I think that, you know, much like as a young person, you didn't have the language to put to what you were experiencing internally about your body and about your identity. I think a lot of cisgendered men like Ben and I have some kind of dysphoria with the hegemonic or predominant assertions about masculinity, where it doesn't quite fit. We don't feel like we are enough. We feel, we vacillate between shame and guilt or overcompensating or trying to present in ways that, you know, get rewarded or are seen as valid or legitimate expressions of masculinity. And I think that your story of having to really move into manhood and then deconstruct manhood as that happens is so helpful, because it actually gives me language to access things that are just like maybe peripheral feelings or, you know, stuff I've repressed. It really is such a gift. So thank you for being with us. Thanks for spending time with us. I wonder, as we close, if you could talk about a little bit about your work at Queer Theology and how people can find you out on the web.
Yeah. So queertheology.com is a project that I started with Brian G. Murphy about 12, 13 years ago. And we're really working to move the conversation about LGBTQ plus issues and faith beyond 101 or beyond a kind of defensive posture to taking yes, obviously you can be queer or trans and a person of faith as a starting point, and then saying, how do you integrate your identity with your spiritual practice? What might churches and spiritual communities and straight and cisgender folks have to learn from queer and trans people of faith? So opening up those conversations, we have a podcast, an online community, lots and lots of workshops and courses. You can find us at queertheology.com for that. And then I'm also on most of the social medias and have my own website at shannontlkearns.com, on social media at shannontlkearns, and would love to connect with folks.
The book again is No One Taught Me How to Be a Man, What a Trans Man's Experience Reveals About Masculinity. Shannon, it's been a joy and an honor to be with you today. Thanks for spending time with us.
Yeah, thank you so much for having me. Really appreciate it.
You know what, Ben, you probably don't know what, but I'll tell you. I really appreciated Shannon talking about, he referred several times to sort of the precarious, vulnerable situation that trans people are in today, and how people whose identity are weaponized, right? So in our world today, immigrants, members of the LGBTQ community, maybe most pressing would be trans people. They actually have to do a lot of work that guys like you and I don't do to ensure their own bodily safety.
Right.
And I think that members in majority cultures or people who benefit the most from whatever prevailing supremacy culture is in operation, it's something that we just don't, maybe we can hear about it and be like, oh, that sucks. But I think what's foreign to me, what I'm noticing is foreign to me in that conversation is I don't have an experiential touch point to know what the cost of that is.
Right.
Emotionally, relationally, physically, spiritually. I don't know what's the cost of that, and how does that impact, you know, people's flourishing.
Yeah. I think, you know, it's one thing to hear about it and to even try to empathize with it, you know, and try to enter into that experience. But yeah, unless there is an experiential touch point, I think it's hard. It's hard to know. Like I'm even thinking about just as an analog to that is just how, like this, you know, the current administration, you know, in the United States and everything that's happening now has seemed to activate a lot of people, you know, into like activist spaces, you know, protesting, things like that. But one of the phenomenon that I noticed about it is that it seems to be activating a lot of white people. And the response, and this is an overgeneralization, mm-hmm. but the response of a lot of the black people that I've seen has been like, well, yeah, this is our backs have been up against this wall for a long time. And you're just now waking up to it, which is fine, but like, do your work. And I was just recognizing like part of the work that I'm feeling in my body is like, you know, is like, oh, this is exhausting. Mm-hmm. And I like, you know, you can sort of intellectually understand, oh yeah, things are hard, you know, for people of color and all that kind of thing. But when you have some kind of experience that begins to be some sort of analog to it, like there's a different kind of learning, a different kind of realization, you know, I mean, I wouldn't want to say that we're experiencing any of that fully, but just getting a taste of it, like there is a different kind of learning that settles into your body to be like, oh, okay.
Yeah.
It's helpful.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. What other things are you thinking about?
I guess I'm thinking about it's, I was struck by the very careful, very deliberate way that Shannon had to like calibrate how he was coming across in the world in order to like generate a response, you know, that was safe, you know, and favorable from other people, whether that's just misgendering him, you know, with pronouns and stuff like that. But that's, you know, hearing his story, it's like, well, that's so much more than just a preference. Like there's safety issues associated with that.
Mm-hmm.
Right. Even though it is also a preference that,
yeah,
you know, that should be honored. But I was just thinking about how carefully and explicitly he had to think through those things, but also like how I'm like, okay, well, maybe in a quieter way, I have asked those same questions. I mean, you asked this in the interview, like there, you know, I've had questions about what it means to be a man, you know, what is masculinity? Mm-hmm. You know, see the toxic elements of it. And you're like, ugh, no, that is bad. That's sinful, you know?
Yeah.
That's ugly. But then, and then, you know, you learn about, well, yeah, a lot of what we think of biblical manhood, so to speak, is like, okay, well, that's 1950s John Wayne, you know, nonsense. It doesn't have to do with the Bible.
No.
Necessarily. And so a lot of it is socially constructed. Yeah. So what does that mean? You know,
yeah,
to inhabit this, I guess, way of being that we've called masculine.
Yeah, part of it is that the white Western European sort of conceptual toolkit doesn't give us immediate access to things like systems and structures, mm-hmm. That form and shape us. So like things like patriarchy, inside of which masculine toxic masculinity sort of asserts itself as normal or acceptable, right, or virtuous. Like we don't see that as a problem or B as a cultural shaping force. We also, a lot of, you know, men who exhibit toxic masculinity up until very recently were celebrated, rewarded, and idolized. Mm. You know, it's just, there's been a cultural shift in the last probably 15 years where there's an increasing, like using Shannon's language, there's increasing language and labels to talk about abusive behavior that is embodied and inherent in toxic masculinity, yeah, right? So you can perform toxic masculinity as a woman, but it's most embodied or primarily expressed as attributes traditionally known as male.
Right.
And so I think there's naming that as harmful People feel that as a threat. People experience
so
that.
Identified yeah, with people, that definition that it's like, well, this does their bodies register it as an existential threat because it's like, this is my identity and you're telling me it's wrong.
Yeah.
And it's bad.
Yeah. And so maybe some of the work is relearning how to relate to, you know, these attributes that are, that harm other people. You know, that's one of the filters I think that Shannon has that's important. He talked about how one of the ethical frames he uses is, it will this performance or this embodiment of masculinity, will it hurt somebody else?
Yeah.
Right? So maybe, you know, this isn't what Shannon probably was referring to, but like maybe he would want to raise his voice and use his big boy voice, you know, but he sees how yelling hurts people.
Right.
And so he decides that's not a way to embody my masculinity. That's faithful.
Right.
And I think differentiating between the harm I cause by yelling at someone else versus the harm that a cisgendered person reports that Shannon's existence causes them.
Yeah.
Right? Because that's part of the narrative, right? That Shannon's existence
is a threat to
men.
Marriage or gender or whatever.
Or men.
Yeah. Or men in general, right?
Right. Yeah. Yeah. And I think we have to be able to talk about the difference between those reported harms.
Yeah.
So that we can talk carefully, compassionately, but also faithfully about what is harmful.
Yeah.
Because the last thing I want to do is equate those reports of harm as equal or just gaslight people.
Yeah, you're not being harmed.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, but to identify what is the threat you're experiencing right now? Should we identify it as harm? Should we identify it as, you know, a threat? Sort of what are you afraid of? I think that's important to delineate, like what's actually being threatened here. Mm-hmm. Is it someone's well-being and life, you know, or is this something about, you know, the way that we've come to identify that's being threatened that actually would be good for us to question, you know, and let go of, you know, and trust that there is goodness and life on the other side of letting go of things that we've over-identified with.
Yeah. So I know I've mentioned this before, but an example from my life comes up here. I'll try to do this quickly. You and I can see each other, and I'm wearing a golf shirt today. It's blue with a pink collar, and it's got pink flamingos on it and watermelons
and leaves.
And my kids are always giving me grief that, my daughter said yesterday, "You are the zestiest straight man I know." Now, zesty is a word that, Gen Alpha, Gen Z use for as a synonym for gay.
Okay.
Okay. And this is an ongoing thing in our family. Like my nieces and nephews think that I'm gay. Mm-hmm. But I'm not, but I tend to present in traditionally non-masculine ways. You know, I used to get called ma'am all the time in drive-thrus. I sort of laugh at that. I kind of laugh at it. No one's attacking me. I don't have any nieces and nephews disowning me, etc. But about 20 years ago, I remember being at a conference and I was engaging with somebody there in a very silly, like I'm a silly person. When I get excited, I get animated and demonstrative. And a friend of mine, after like 2 days of this conference, was like, "Hey, man, I think that person was a woman. I think she likes you." And I was like, "No, she doesn't like me." And you're wrong. And it turns out, later in a conversation, it became apparent to me that she thought I was flirting with her. And now I've always been sort of like oblivious, you know, I don't know how to flirt really. Mm-hmm. So it didn't occur to me that I was flirting with her, but I realized that being that way with her sent her signals that weren't helpful for her or me.
Yeah, right.
And so from that moment, I've actually changed the way that I relate to some people so as not to cause them harm.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah. And the harm would be leading them on to think that you have interest that you don't really have.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. So noticing my impact. Yeah. And I do think it's different to wear like a colorful shirt and act silly with my kids and they call me zesty. Mm-hmm. That there's a different impact there than the way that I relate to women as a married man.
Yeah. And the other part of that calculus too, of course, is that it's not always good to conform or to shift and change the way that you operate because of the perception of the other person, right? Like that, a lot of people have trauma around that where it's like, I can't be myself, you know?
Right.
If they're, you know, coming from a place of lack of power or lack of privilege. And so I think it just requires wisdom to know when it's like, you know what, that's your problem. And, you know, you'll have to talk to Jesus about that. And when it's more like, actually, you know what, this could actually be a way for me to love people in a better, if I change, you know?
Yeah. Yeah. Right. And that, you know, Shannon's story about being in the bookstore and being himself led him to being misgendered.
Yeah.
But performing a more stereotypical sort of emotionally unaffected masculine mm-hmm. kind of presentation. So like he could be himself, get misgendered and feel out of his body. Mm-hmm. Or mask part of who he was so he could be seen for who he was. I mean, so I think we're always dealing with complicated or complex things like this.
Yes.
But Shannon's story helps us, I think, name it better.
Yeah.
Maybe before we go, Ben, I wanted to tell you about some research I came across.
Well, thanks. I'm always eager to hear the distillation of the research that you have read. I'm eager to hear it.
I know.
I'm always eager to hear it.
I can tell that's full of sincerity. Also, mm-hmm. I know you are a man of faith and science. So here we go.
I'm masking how excited I am by affecting boredom and a monotone voice.
Yeah. Well, I appreciate that. I feel like that's a sarcastic troll. And there's nothing totally I love more than a sarcastic troll.
This is me loving you, Matt.
That you should not brush your teeth with your left hand.
Why is that?
They say that a toothbrush is much more effective.
Oh, very good.
All right.
Dentists everywhere are saying, don't brush your teeth with your left hand.
Yeah, don't use your hand.
Yeah.
Use a toothbrush.
Yeah, use a toothbrush. We've designed a technology specifically for this.
I like that. Pro tip.
I like that. Yeah, this podcast is nothing if not without its pro tips. I got confused in my negatives there. This podcast is nothing if not helpful in giving you pro tips.
Okay.
This podcast is nothing if not full of pro tips.
This podcast is nothing.
This podcast is nothing if not full of a dearth of pro tips.
Ben, it's time for us to go.
Okay, bye.
Bye.
Thanks for joining us for this episode of the Gravity Podcast. If you're finding it helpful, please tell your friends about it. Word of mouth is the best advertising. Ratings and reviews online also help others find the podcast. And don't forget to subscribe so you don't miss an episode. To join discussions about the podcast and lots more, join us in the Gravity community. It's free to join, and you can connect with other listeners to the podcast to talk about faith, spirituality, and whatever else comes up. Also, Ben and I hang out there a lot. To join, go to gravitycommons.com/community. The Gravity Podcast is produced by Ben Sternke and Matt Tebbe. Aaron Sternke edits and mixes the podcast. You can check out his mixing, engineering, and production work at aaronsternke.com. And we'd love to hear from you. To record a question or comment for us, go to gravitycommons.com/message and click the Start Recording button. You can also email us at podcast@gravitycommons.com. Catch you next time.
This is an ad by Regain Couples Therapy and features real testimonials.
This was our first time trying therapy, and honestly, it was long overdue. Looking back, we just wish we had started sooner.
Regain's qualified therapists help couples when they can't get there on their own.
We thought it was intimacy issues, but Andrea helped us uncover a deeper root cause we hadn't even realized was there.
Visit regain.com/couplespod to get 10% off your first month. Regain, powered by BetterHelp.
Finding great candidates to hire can be like, well, trying to find a needle in a haystack. Sure, you can post your job to some job board, but then all you can do is hope the right person comes along. Which is why you should try ZipRecruiter for free at ziprecruiter.com/zip. ZipRecruiter doesn't depend on candidates finding you. It finds them for you. Its powerful technology identifies people with the right experience and actively invites them to apply to your job. You get qualified candidates fast. So while other companies might deliver a lot of hay, ZipRecruiter finds you what you're looking for. The needle in the haystack.
See why 4 out of 5 employers who post a job on ZipRecruiter get a quality candidate within the first day. ZipRecruiter, the smartest way to hire. And right now, you can try ZipRecruiter for free. That's right, free. At ZipRecruiter.com/zip. That's ZipRecruiter.com/zip. ZipRecruiter.com/zip.